On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, heat wave, Afghan turmoil, Santorum winds, and the White House hits the campaign trail. Vice President Joe Biden hit the stump swinging. Here he is in Ohio.
I want to tell you what's real bankruptcy. The economic theories of Gingrich, Santorum, and Romney. They are bankrupt. If you give any one of these guys the keys to the White House, they will bankrupt the middle class again.
Rick Santorum savored a pair of big primary victories in the South. Said again, he's the guy.
The time is now to make sure that we have the best chance to win this election. And the best chance to win this election is to nominate a conservative to go up against Barack Obama, who can take him on every issue.
And turmoil in Afghanistan after a terrible massacre. Afghans in Jalalabad said, U.S., go home. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with National Journal's Major Garrett, Christian Friedland of Reuters, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What is going on in Afghanistan? Does Santorum have a real shot at the GOP nomination? Were you wearing short shorts in winter this week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Washington today, we're joined by Major Garrett, White House correspondent for National Journal. Major, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you here from New York. Christian Friedland joins us, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital and a very smart eye on the world. Christian, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. And thank you for calling me smart. Always nice to hear.
You earn it. And from the studios of Dartmouth College today in Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Christian.
I want to go straight to Afghanistan. I mean, it's just one thing after another this week, starting with the terrible massacre. We do not know all the details yet, and that in itself, that we don't even know the name of the alleged American staff sergeant shooter there, is quite remarkable. But Chris, just stepping back from this, Taliban says no to talks. I mean, they were barely talks, but the idea was central to the American idea of getting out. Now they say that's off. President Karzai in Afghanistan saying we want American troops confined to not just base, but big bases out of the village scene. All that pushback we've seen in the streets for weeks now, what do you see going on with this war effort, Christian?
Well, you know, I think you're right, Tom. It is a very depressing and a very frightening turn of events. And I think if you imagine what it must feel like from the Afghan perspective, the Koran burning clearly touched a very painful cultural nerve. And felt, you know, incredibly disrespectful, incredibly humiliating. And then coming so soon afterwards, this shooting, you know, imagine that some Muslim soldiers were occupying the United States and you had a Bible burning followed by a massacre in some small town in the heartland.
My imagination is reeling already, yeah.
Right? I mean, just imagine what the impact of that would be. And what I think is so tragic is, you know, I think that the West, America, has been doing really important work in Afghanistan and work, you know, especially at the local level that a few months ago you would have said, you know, was starting to lay the foundations, yes, not for a Switzerland, but for something better than Afghanistan has been, you know, in the past 40 years. And I'm really worried that we've just watched all of that unravel.
Washington really working hard to project a steady-as-she-goes message here while, what, we saw the guy drive onto the tarmac and is burn himself up as the Secretary of Defense landed. Their story today of another Afghan driver trying to run down with his vehicle, U.S. top brass in Afghanistan. Here was Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta this week when he's been in Afghanistan talking about the general scenario, sort of calm down, calm down.
We'll be challenged by our enemy, we'll be challenged by ourselves, we'll be challenged by the hell of war itself. But none of that must ever deter us from the mission that we must achieve.
Leon Panetta on Wednesday talking to Marines at Camp Leatherneck. That's in southern Afghanistan. Major Garrett, do you see the timeline changing as a result of what's going on here? Politically, this is the last thing, presumably, Barack Obama wants to see, is Afghanistan blowing up on the way to an election. But how is all this hitting policymakers in Washington, Major?
At several different levels, Tom. First of all, let's talk about the White House. There was a concerted effort today, this week, everything the president said, everyone who spoke on his behalf, and at the press conference with British Prime Minister David Cameron, to say this is a setback, this is a tragedy, this is something that will be fully investigated, the person will be held accountable. Now, it's worth pointing out parenthetically that in Afghanistan, they don't believe it's a single U.S. soldier, a staff sergeant. They believe there was more than one person involved, and that's becoming a huge thorn in their side about the way this investigation has been conducted. But the administration has done everything to say we take this seriously, but we are not going to change the current timeline. That's the public posture, and that will remain the public posture until another decision is made. But there is now a growing debate within the administration, and I think it's going to be visited when the G8 members meet at Camp David very shortly, and then there's a massive NATO conference in Chicago. All the nations involved are going to say, look, let us measure the training of the Afghan army and police. Because if you go to the tail end of what Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, said, nothing will deter us from completing our mission successfully. Well, most people in America have completely lost sight of, A, what the mission is, and B, what successful completion of that mission would or should look like. That is the great problem for the administration. And I think it's significant that Newt Gingrich on the campaign trail said this week, we should get out because we can't achieve what we're trying to achieve. And it was missed last week, but I think it's significant. Two Tea Party-aligned senators, Mike Lee of Utah and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Now, maybe people might not think it's interesting that Rand Paul wrote this, but Rand Paul has never been as far out as his father, Ron Paul, on the no wars, bring everything home sort of foreign policy approach. They both signed a letter with 21 other Democrats and Bernie Sanders of Vermont saying, Mr. President, dramatically accelerate the pace of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think you're going to be able to see sooner rather than later Republicans joining this call to say the mission is not well understood. Even if it is understood, it's unlikely to succeed. We're wasting our time, we're wasting our treasure, and we're wasting our reputation. Let's move on out.
Jack Beattie, I want to get you on this, but we've got callers on the Afghan front. Brad in Clarksville, Tennessee. Brad, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I served in Afghanistan. I only did one combat tour, but I was a squad leader over there. And I served with soldiers who had had multiple deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we also saw people die. We all saw, you know, our friends lose body parts. And there's just no excuse for walking into a village and shooting it up. I mean, I heard his defense attorney on the news this morning, and I just want to say there's no excuse. I think the president has a good plan, getting out as soon as we can, and I think we just should just – it's time to go.
What about two more years, Brad? Should we hang in till the end of 2014? Do you think that would make things better, or start pulling the plug now? You served.
Well, that's a good question. The Afghan soldiers have been taking the lead for a while. I mean, when I was over there, we were already teaching them how to do things. They were supposed to be at the front of everything we did. And I think there's a benefit to staying for two more years, but the sooner we get out, the better, I think. But I support the president.
Brad, we've got it. You're a good military man there with that, but we hear the impulse within it. Jack Beattie, I mean, the news is coming out today that reportedly a buddy of this staff sergeant had had his leg blown off in a day or days before this attack. This is all reported. We don't know exactly what happened there. He is now, we're told, expected to be flown to the U.S. military prison in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, as early as today. Now, Brad was there, who just called. He served. He was out as a squad leader. But President Karzai in Afghanistan is now saying, we don't just want you to go back to base. We want you back to the big bases. This in southern Afghanistan, this example was at a small little special forces forward base. He doesn't want those anymore. I mean, that is effectively, Jack, walking away from the strategy without leaving the country.
Yes, it is. And he was quoted on the BBC just this morning saying, we're at the end of the road, almost end of the rope. And basically saying that we've reached a point where we can't go on with the Americans as we have been. You know, to us, this looks like madness, an aberrant act. To the Afghans, as one reads the press, it's clear it seems continuous with American policy. I mean, they don't distinguish between civilians killed in battle because of these night raids and so on, and civilians just murdered. To them, it's all civilian death. And this strategy we've been following, this, you know, the president spoke of it the other day, still with some pride attached to it. It's hard to see the rationale. He called it, you know, a war of necessity when he escalated in 2009, when he sent the 30,000 troops there. No one can think that today. As you look back, and of course, what is his priority today? People say 2014. But in fact, the urgent priority for the Pentagon now is to negotiate an agreement with the government there that would keep U.S. forces in some strength there till 2024.
But Karzai is saying back to your base now, and the Taliban saying, no, we don't want to talk, even though that was central to this thing. I mean, Chrystia Freeland, you know, they're talking order, but sometimes it feels like a Saigon exit could be at the end of this road. Something really just helter-skelter.
What a grim scenario, Tom. I think to Jack's point, I do think that it's important to go back now to first principles and to ask, what is the mission? You know, you started off, Tom, by saying it's maybe not clear to a lot of people in America. Maybe that's not sort of ignorance or lack of understanding or lack of explanation. Maybe that's because the mission right now isn't clear.
I don't know if it's back to first principles or back to the airport. And on the plane, we're talking about the week in the news with Chrystia Freeland, Major Garrett, and Jack Beatty. Listeners, you can join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news today. Afghanistan turmoil. Santorum takes Dixie this week. Obama, Biden take the stump. Major Garrett is with us from National Journal. White House correspondent there. Chrystia Freeland joins us from New York. Editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Is this the moment of truth in Afghanistan? Is it falling apart faster than we can patch it together, faster than we can get out? And the politics. Does Rick Santorum have a real shot at the GOP nomination? What do you hear this week from the Vice President Biden on the trail? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. It wasn't all grim. A moment of lightness this week as President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron stood side by side at the White House. Apparently enough time has passed now to joke about the War of 1812. In the White House ceremony there, welcoming Cameron, President Obama had this to say about the conflict, which saw the British Army torch the White House, the U.S. Capitol, and the Library of Congress.
It's now been 200 years since the British came here to the White House under somewhat different circumstances. They made quite an impression. They really lit up the place. But we moved on.
Old war jokes. Prime Minister Cameron responded.
Now, looking around me, I can see you've got the place a little better defended today. You're clearly not taking any risks with the Brits this time.
But we've got a war right now. Major Garrett, I want to come back again to Washington policy and whether you can imagine a change here. Or does the Obama administration just batten down the hatches and find a way to hang in because you've got a November election coming here?
Well, remember this. The current schedule for troop withdrawals is 23,000 of the combat personnel that was part of the 33,000 surge will be leaving by September of this year. That's already baked into the cake. The question is, what is the footprint after that? That would take the current troop level, which is 91,000, down to about 68,000. Mm-hmm. And then how long do they stay? What is their mission? And do they remain there in substantial numbers all throughout 2013 and then begin a gradual withdrawal in 2014? It's going to be the pace of the movement of that roughly 68,000 U.S. military personnel post-September of this year. Because, again, 23,000 already moving out by September, that's already in the mix. And what the president's going to have to confront is not just domestic politics changing, as I indicated before, But he's going to have to take the measure of President Karzai, because if President Karzai is absolutely adamant, if he's serious, or if he's just speaking rhetorically and blowing off steam, and he's done a little bit of both in our long history, mm-hmm. but if he's serious about U.S. military personnel moving out entirely of all these forward bases and these sort of pacification areas that we've tried to create, then there is really no point in having U.S. forces there because, A, they can't do the mission, and, B, they'll be sitting ducks. They will be absolute targets sitting inside sort of a fortress United States within Afghanistan. And what I think will be the rational question to the White House is the point of that.
Of course, U.S. Armed Forces sources telling Pentagon reporters that's not going to happen. But what does that mean? If Karzai says do this and they say, no, John in Boston is calling. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yes. Does everyone really believe it's a coincidence that in these two theaters, both Iraq and Afghanistan, without the mission being clear that these are the countries that border Iran and that are lingering there may have something to do with waiting until the conflict manifests itself there?
Interesting. Christopher Freeland, an American effort to stay on Iran's flanks as long as the nuclear issue is unresolved? Christia?
Sure. I mean, I think Iran is the last remaining powerful and very hostile country in the region. And although we've been talking a lot about Afghanistan and, you know, focusing on the potential complications that that poses leading up to the election, I think that in the White House, Iran is actually the country that people are the most worried about. And they're worried because, you know, if things escalate there, facing the choice between, you know, being pressured by Israel to support or even to launch a preemptive strike is, you know, a hugely difficult issue for the White House. And it's especially difficult because it has immediate domestic implications. We're talking about Afghanistan, but it doesn't touch the lives of that many Americans directly, you know, apart from people like Brad. Actually, my own husband is in Afghanistan right now. But Iran touches people very, very directly because it has an impact on oil prices.
Is your husband reporting there? Is he serving in the military? What's he doing, Christian?
Yeah, he's reporting there.
Yeah. I mean, Jack, talking about logistics, even just getting out of Afghanistan, there's this negotiation going on to the north, about whether U.S. troops could pull out that way. The doors are still closed on the Pakistan front. This is, you know, talk about Iran, just getting out if and when we want to may have its own challenges, Jack.
Oh, indeed. As grave as getting in, you know, and of course, all this time, the snow is melting in the passes and the fighting season is about to begin again. And since the president escalated, 964 Americans have died. Only 900 had died in all the years, the 8 years before that there. So that's what this surge strategy has cost us in lives. In treasure, who knows how you can even begin to count? And you know, when you go back and you look at the president's process in figuring out this strategy, there was a fork in the road, and it looks like he chose the wrong one. The fork was the Biden policy of counterterrorism, of a sort of small unit there that we'd use to strike at any.
Don't try to build
fledgling.
A nation, just hit terrorists even from the
That's
sky
right.
or with
That's
the
right.
special
That's
forces,
right.
whatever. Mm-hmm.
Something consistent with our security interest, which is not to make Afghanistan into Switzerland or even to, a better Afghanistan, but rather simply to contain the damage, the threat from al-Qaeda. The president didn't choose that. He went in the direction of escalation. He went in the direction of the Petraeus counterinsurgency strategy. And partly, you know, I think he did that part just to sort of buy off Petraeus. I mean, let's face it, the prospect of him as a presidential candidate, I think, was frightening. And partly to buy off the military. The military was pushing for this. They said, we can do, Mr. President. They applied a model from Iraq to Afghanistan. That model is not working. And so, you know, the president should be an issue in the campaign. And I really hope something develops here, because the president should answer for what looks to have been a bad choice.
I want to get to politics, but a couple more calls on Afghanistan. Bruce in Providence, Rhode Island. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Has any consideration been given to the prospect of turning the staff sergeant responsible for those murders over to the Afghan government for disposition within their judicial system. We're planning on turning the reins over to them shortly. This was not an act. These killings didn't occur during a combat mission. It really is more, seems like a civil matter. And perhaps the appropriate venue for justice there is in Afghanistan.
Bruce, I appreciate your call. Of course, the call there has been, Afghans have said very loudly that's what they want. But Major Garrett, I mean, this is a point where the U.S. military was just won't budge. I mean, they walked away from an agreement with Iraq about staying longer, which they really wanted because they couldn't get this kind of immunity to keep Americans within the American military justice system, Major.
Precisely. Bruce raises an important question, but I can guarantee you the answer is no. It will not happen. And if you go to the National Journal website and look for my colleague Yochi Driesen, who's one of our outstanding defense correspondents, he wrote about this earlier this week, saying that not only is there absolutely, positively no chance that the United States military will turn the staff sergeant over to Afghanistan officials for processing and trial in their judicial system, the judicial process applied by the U.S. military is very slow and oftentimes inflicts what those in the host country who feel aggrieved rarely consider to be just punishment. I recommend both his stories on that. Mm. And the larger question also falls into this category. Now, there have been murders of U.S. military advisors, we believe, by their Afghan advisors or
well, we know in a number of cases at this point.
In a number of
and
cases,
we're learning of more.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. General John Allen on CNN earlier this week was not declarative in saying we know for sure these were all Afghans and we were working side by side with them, but that's certainly the way it looks. Well, they're being processed by the Afghan side of the judicial system, not ours. And so it's in this way, both nations say, well, you have a system, no one's particularly happy with it, but let's keep the systems as they are.
Steve in Killingworth, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You know, as disgusted and dismayed as I am that our military is still there, you would say, how can we afford to stay? I feel, how can we afford, we won't be able to afford to go back in. If we leave and the area invariably melts down, which it will, it's not just Iran who's hostile in the area, it's Pakistan with their nuclear weapons, et cetera. So it'll melt down, and what will our forward operating base be? Saudi Arabia? So invariably we're going to need to get back in. And lastly, Christian made a comment of, you know, we could see someone burning Bibles in the heartland. I think that's kind of an inappropriate analogy because the entire area is just lawless. You know, the women's rights are gone. They kill their own people.
No, I get it. That was a big stretch of the imagination. But I guess it's a scenario that she's describing for us. But Christian, I mean, here's the thing. We have been told by the sitting president this is a conflict we must win. This one's essential to American national security. And now we've got this kind of unraveling, and as our caller says, can't stay, can't go.
Sure, and I think that's a very good point, and it's useful for those of us who pontificate to reflect upon the fact that sometimes there are no ideal solutions, only a choice between less bad ones. But I would come back, Tom, to the point with which you began, that I think the real problem with Afghanistan right now is that you said, you know, the president says this is a conflict we must win. I think the real issue is trying to figure out what constitutes winning. You know, does winning mean doing a deal with the Taliban? Does winning mean, you know, a Kerry-style, maybe a shift of course, as Jack was saying, a shift of course to a Kerry-style policing operation?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you do have to change your strategy when the facts change. That was, you know, the famous Winston Churchill line. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing on the ground is a real surge of local hostility to the U.S. and the Western forces. And I think there does need to be a response to that.
Well, I mean, I'm going to put this one on the shelf, but it's hard to do a deal with the Taliban when they don't want to talk. It's hard to make strategy if you don't have, you know, you're going to have a little time to make a strategy, and we'll see what happens there. I want to go to politics, and listeners, you can join us on this. I mean, here we have these Southern victories this week by Rick Santorum. Does Rick Santorum have a real shot at the GOP nomination? Can Mitt Romney grind it out? Should Gingrich get out? And is Joe Biden right on the stump now? Would the GOP, quote-unquote, bankrupt the middle class? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's Mitt Romney on Wednesday following those losses in Mississippi and Alabama, but he got Hawaii and American Samoa and reminded Fox News' Megyn Kelly that he's still the front runner on the delegate count.
I'm glad that I've got, I think, about twice as many delegates as anyone else in the process. But this is ultimately a question about who can get the support of the Republican Party and independents to be able to win the White House. And I'm very pleased with the fact that over the last several contests, I've earned a million more votes than has either Senator Santorum or Speaker Gingrich.
He's got votes, he's got delegates, but will he have the nomination? On the Glenn Beck radio show on Tuesday, Rick Santorum said Newt Gingrich should get out of the race.
Whether he does well or not, I don't think it's going to matter much. I mean, he's just not attracting votes anywhere else. And it'd be great if he'd get out of the race, because clearly the vast majority of the votes that he is taking are coming from me.
Why do you suppose he's doing this? The only thing I can think of is he wants a brokered convention.
Yes, I think that's it.
Brokered convention. People are talking about that as a real possibility. Gingrich this week talking with Greta Van Susteren on Wednesday. He's not going anywhere.
It's a three-way race, I think, at the present time. I'm third among the three, but we're continuing to campaign, continuing to develop ideas. And I have a hunch that, just as has happened in the past, the more we watch Romney and Santorum fight, the more attractive I'll look, and the more I will regain strength as people look at my solutions rather than politics as usual.
Major Garrett, we'll come to Mitt Romney, but first these two. Can you see, do you hear anything going on that would get Newt Gingrich out of the race and clear up the conservative votes, maybe more of them for Santorum?
No, I don't see it. And I would argue a couple of things on behalf of the idea that Gingrich ought to stay in. First of all, he makes a credible case that on energy policy, whether you agree that his plan would create $2.50 a gallon gasoline.
Well, I think I heard him say $1.25 in the last 24 hours.
Many experts do not, but Gingrich can rightfully say that within the context of this national debate, he has been a significant figure. The White House has responded to him either by name or by implication several times. I would say parenthetically, I think the White House is doing that for a couple of reasons. A, it disagrees, and B, it wants to give Gingrich every reason to stay in this race because they want to prolong this as long as possible. And Gingrich can also say, look, I came in a strong second in Mississippi and Alabama. Yes, I didn't win, but I didn't get blown out. And he has had more lives in this campaign than any other candidate. And I think he wants to stay until the Pennsylvania primary in April 24th. He was born in Pennsylvania. I think he's going to ride it out at least until then. And he has some, I think, justification to do that. Santorum wants him to get out, assuming that he'll get all of Gingrich's votes. I'm not sure that's true, but even if it is true, unless Romney drops out, the only way Santorum can win this nomination before Tampa in late August at the convention is if Romney drops out. Romney's not going to drop out.
What about a brokered convention? People wrote that off a week ago, and now again this week, they're sort of creeping back, and people saying, you know, maybe Santorum can keep Romney from having enough to win, and it rolls into Tampa undecided.
I think we need to change our language. It's not a brokered convention. Brokered conventions suggest there's a brokering agent or a brokering body or a set of wise men and women who will put together and make the decision. What this caucus and primary process has taught us, if it has taught us anything, is that the quote-unquote elites in the Republican Party, the establishment to the degree it exists, doesn't matter. Republican voters have had every opportunity to vote their own party's long-term best interest, end this contest earlier, go with the inevitable Mitt Romney, make him the nominee, let him talk about the general election campaign. Many have said in the exit polls they know that's in their own self-interest, or they say that's their highest priority, and yet they don't vote for Romney. Operationally, Republican voters are deciding to keep this going because they don't like Romney enough to end this sooner rather than later. They're in charge. Nobody else is in charge. What we will have is a negotiated convention if it goes that far, not a brokered one, which means deals cut between those who have delegates and those who need them.
What does negotiated mean? Between Santorum forces and Romney forces?
Look at it this way, and I didn't believe this was in any way, shape, or form possible even 30 days ago. But let's say Romney has the vast majority of delegates, but he's about 200 short when he heads to Tampa. Then Rick Santorum says the following. Governor Romney, you need something I have. You have something I want. Put me on the ticket and we'll solve this right now. If you don't, it'll be a Donnybrook and I wish you the best.
Wow.
I think Santorum has now placed himself in a position of negotiating his position on the ticket. Not only that, but if it goes this long and it's that close, cabinet secretaries, policy, platform positions, a whole range of issues.
Maybe a Santorum stamp on a Romney nomination. Maybe more if his backers get their way. Major Garrett with National Journal. Please stand by in Washington. Christopher Freeland in New York. Jack Beatty in Hanover, New Hampshire. Listeners, you can join us. Does Santorum have a real shot here? Can Romney grind it out? Is Joe Biden right when he goes after the GOP on the middle class? Is President Obama right? Republicans would go backwards on energy. And what about the Goldman Sachs parting shot? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news, this week, hundreds and hundreds of records for warm winter weather broken. All the way to the Canadian border, weird. Chicago resident Carolyn Bergen sunbathing along Lake Michigan in mid-March said she didn't care about what was behind it.
This is a good thing. Why question it? Let's just enjoy it.
Let's just enjoy it. Former Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich left his Chicago home for a federal prison in Colorado to start a 14-year sentence for corruption.
Now you guys can go home and our neighbors can get their neighborhood back.
What's going to sustain you?
I'll see you guys.
Now what's going to sustain you?
When I see you. Okay. I'll see you around.
See you when I see you. And it's March Madness bracket time. Colorado's Carlin Brown came up big, and the Buffaloes went on to beat the University of Las Vegas in round one of the NCAA basketball tournament, 68-64.
Now taken by Dave Rice, a five-point swing. Brown dunks!
We're looking at a week in the news. Afghanistan turmoil. Santorum takes Dixie. Obama, Biden take to the stump. Major Garrett is with us from National Journal in Washington. Christian Freeland with Thomson Reuters Digital in New York City. And Jack Beatty's here. What do you think? Is Mitt Romney going to grind this thing out after all? Does Santorum have a shot? Is Joe Biden right with the GOP, quote-unquote, bankrupt the middle class? And will the Goldman Sachs parting shot that we saw this week matter? Greg Smith's look back in anger. What do you say this week on Blagojevich to pink slime in our burgers to Encyclopedia Britannica's final run? And what about this crazy summer weather in winter? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Matt in Boston, you're on the air, Matt.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Well.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, what's up? What do you think, Matt?
Well, you were just talking about, Santorum and how if we get to the convention, an open convention, how Santorum has the capacity to, maybe get a vice presidency or something because Romney won't be able to win without him. What I think is really interesting is how you leave out that Ron Paul is widely renowned to have second in delegates. I mean, he might not win due to the shenanigans going on in Iowa where they lose votes.
I take your point, but I don't think he has second in delegates. Romney, as I read it here, this is Washington Post, is 494 now for Romney. Santorum, 251, and then right on down. But Ron Paul supporters are strong. Joe in Asheville, North Carolina. Joe, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I may have an interesting perspective. I was classmate of Mitt Romney's at Harvard Business School.
Okay.
I enrolled in 72. I believe he came in 71 because he was in the four-year MBA JD program. He has two degrees, two graduate degrees.
Right, simultaneous, Harvard. Very unusual, not easy to do. He did it. What do you think of the man? Good for the presidency?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And he was very, very impressive at the Harvard Business School. I'll tell you, he had good things to say and kind of amazed me. I was just, we were all a lot younger back then, and I had very limited business experience. I came out of the U.S. Navy. I was an officer. And I met his wife back then. He's been married to her for, I don't know, since whatever.
So what do you say, Santorum, stand aside? Gingrich, stand aside? Let Mitt have it?
I don't know that to stand aside. I don't think it's been necessarily bad for the Republican Party. I know they're in the trenches fighting it out. I believe Republicans will generally coalesce in the direction of Romney. And by the way, I don't know why Santorum believes that if Romney does not take it before the convention that all of a sudden the Romney delegates on the second ballot are going to flock to Santorum. I think it's just as likely that Santorum delegates will flock to Romney.
We got it, Joe. Of course, it's interesting. It's been half a century since we've had anything like that at a major party convention. It would just be amazing to see. You talk about getting in the trenches. The vice president got out there in the trenches on the stump any way you like it this week. And the first thing he did was talk to U.S. auto workers in Ohio and really go after Mitt Romney and then all three of the leading candidates there on the bailout. Mitt Romney said he would have it would have been better for the automakers to go through bankruptcy. Here's Joe Biden.
The president and I made a bet, a simple bet. We bet on you. We bet on American ingenuity. We bet on you, and we won.
President made the tough call, he said. Here's Biden.
He made the tough call, and the verdict is in. President Obama was right, and they were dead wrong.
And then he broadened it to the whole field, or at least the leading three, and to their philosophy.
Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich, these guys have a fundamentally different economic philosophy than we do. Our philosophy, ours is one that values the workers in the success of a business. It values the middle class in the success of our economy.
Christian Phelan, what did you make of Joe Biden's first big outing on the stump there? He said he's going to make a series of four speeches on the economy. There he was with auto workers. You know, he's the guy who's sent out to punch hard. What did you make of his approach?
Well, Detroit is the gift that keeps on giving right now to the Democratic Party, and I think that that's fair enough. I think that they did make a risky bet in bailing out the car companies. I personally thought that it was wrong, and I think that it's been vindicated. On the economic front, I think the vice president is also right. I think that this is going to be an election where there is a pretty profound difference in the sort of core thinking about the economy. What we're seeing from all the Republican candidates is a very sort of supply-side approach. Their thinking is, look, the problem is taxes are too high, there's too much regulation, and as long as we can get the government out of the way, shrink government, everything will be great. What we're hearing from the Democrats, actually, is the economy maybe isn't working like that right now, and that actually you do need government, you need a stronger social safety net than you have right now, and that because of the structure of the economy, you're seeing really surging income inequality with the people at the top taking a lot more of the gains.
Even
and
since 2010.
A tax system that mm-hmm. reflects that. Mm-hmm. So I think there are going to be clear, very clear lines. If Santorum manages to negotiate in the way that Major was talking about, though, I suspect we'll be talking more about women and contraception than we are about the economy.
Well, of course, that's been made a huge issue in recent weeks, and the president's in several settings reaching out on that front. He's going to give a commencement speech at Women's Barnard College in New York coming up. Major, what do you see being marched out here in terms of message as Joe Biden takes the stump?
Well, look, Joe Biden is the administration's way of talking to the constituency that Barack Obama, as President of the United States, has had the most problem connecting to, which is down-income, blue-collar, white Americans. If you look at the men and women, if you look at the voting patterns since 2008, the president has been losing that by a larger percentage than any other demographic group in the country. And Joe Biden is the means by which that communication is best articulated, the White House believes, and most passionately delivered. And the vice president was key on that. So that's why he's been the messenger and will be the messenger of this particular approach to the campaign. Now, the White House and the campaign are not running on their record necessarily other than the auto company bailout. And I guarantee you, 2.5 years ago, if you'd asked anyone in the White House, which I was covering day to day, hour to hour, where do you think you're going to be talking about in November of 2012, health care or the auto bailout? They all said, well, if we get health care, that's what we'll be talking about.
Right.
Because that'll be our huge success. Right. That'll be the transformative policy innovation of all time for the Democrats. That's what we'll be talking about. They're not talking about that. They're talking about the auto bailout. One quick thing about that. It has been a success, and it is measured as a success in Ohio, Michigan, and throughout the industrial Midwest. But it did not come without cost. Remember, every line worker hired since that bailout wakes 50% of the wages previous line workers made, $28 an hour to $14 an hour. And it was after those kinds of very difficult restructuring negotiations and an implied guarantee from the auto workers, no striking, and all the labor union PACs were handled very quickly, very quietly this year as a part of the pressure applied by the administration on this whole deal. Now, for pure free marketeers, those two things, though successful, are anathema. That's the government getting way too heavily involved in industrial policy. But for now, the voters who matter most about this seem to like it.
Jack, I was interested.
I just want to jump in.
Christian, yes, please.
Yeah, no, just quickly, to Major's point that it hasn't been without costs and that the new workers have had to take lower wages.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's true, but I don't think that's going to be a point that you hear the Republicans making very forcefully. Because after all, if you had had a restructuring of the auto industry through bankruptcy, which was the Romney position, I think he would have seen workers hammered much, much harder.
I mean, Mitt Romney's talking about it as a kind of giveaway to the UAW. Jack, I was interested in the vice president's prepared remarks, and I didn't get to hear exactly what he said on the stump, but he's trying to describe different visions of the economy here. And he said, you know, we're about, that is the Democrats, about promoting the private sector. And then this interesting thing, he says, the GOP is about promoting the privileged sector. We're for a fair shot, fair shake. They're about no rules, no risk, no accountability. It's a choice, he said, between a system that's rigged and one that's fair. In the week that this Goldman Sachs departure letter has come out, this is really interesting. He's trying to say, we're for the free market, the really free market. They're for a kind of, you know, rigged, privileged market, but that's being tossed back at the Democrats, as President Obama, as favoring in bailouts, crony capitalism, is Mitt Romney's line, Jack.
That's right. And the vice president also says that if elected, the Republicans will, quote, bankrupt the middle class again. Well, who bankrupted the middle class? Whose idea was it to deregulate Wall Street? When did that happen? Who was the president then? It was Bill Clinton and Larry Summers and that whole group.
Of course, the
George
Republicans
Bush,
right in there with them. I mean, this was very
right
much a
in
joint,
there with
joint
him,
effort.
But they weren't. You know, I mean, Larry Summers overrode Brooksley Bourne at the Commodity Credit Corporation, and you know, we can't have any regulation of derivatives and so on. So it's hard to argue that it was the Republicans that bankrupted the middle class. They had company. And very few Democrats in the Senate, at least, joined Byron Dorgan in voting against that deregulation. But you know, Biden's point that the Republicans are defending privilege. I mean, look at what they've been doing on the budget over the last year. And if you even talk about a fraction, raising taxes on even a fraction of the 1%, no, we can't have that. Because they're the job creators. Well, of course, as NPR threw down the gauntlet, please produce one of these job creators, and you know, a small business that answers to that description. They haven't been able to do it.
Which is odd. A lot of small businesses do create jobs. I don't know exactly what the parameters were for that. I mean, right in the middle of all this week has been gas prices still going up, and Republicans, Newt Gingrich at the fore, making a lot of that. The president coming back this week with a speech in Maryland, pushing back. He talked yesterday about his energy policies at a community college there. Here is the president outlining his vision of a comprehensive national energy policy.
Yes, develop as much oil and gas as we can, but also develop wind power and solar power and biofuels. Make our buildings more fuel efficient. Make our homes more fuel efficient. Make our cars and trucks more fuel efficient so they get more miles for the gallon.
Jack, the president went after Republicans saying that, you know, they want to sort of take us back. They don't believe in the future. He's the all-of-the-above energy guy and really looking to make a strong suit out of that. He said what he's talking about there, like Rutherford B. Hayes on the telephone or something. I don't know if he got that right, Jack.
He apparently got that wrong. Some reporter called the Rutherford B. Hayes library and checked on that. They said, oh, no, Mr.
The
Hayes.
The president said Hayes looked at the telephone and said, who would want to use this? Or nobody
would want to use that?
But that's some kind of internet fiction, maybe it turns
out.
Yeah,
that was an internet fiction, apparently.
Oh, great.
Rutherford
and that's
B.
why
Hayes
he's not on Mount Rushmore, the president said yesterday. Oops.
And there are other reasons as well, including the corrupt bargain that made him president. But you know, the president has he was really on form yesterday, and his case is clear. The Republicans want to drill, baby, drill, and he's saying, look, and this statistic has been questioned too. He says, look, we have 2% of the world's oil resources, and we may have 20% of the demand. Even if all we did was drill morning, noon, and night, we could never meet that. Therefore, we have to go to alternatives. And Mitt Romney has come back and said, oh, you know, you can't put a windmill on the roof of a car. It was unfortunate for him to use that phrase because, of course,
with Seamus Romney's dog,
you can put Seamus on the roof of your car.
Yes, because
the dog is back this week.
And yes, create another form of biomass.
Yes, exactly. And, of course, Stephen Colbert said, of course you can't put a windmill on the roof. That's where you put your dog.
Yeah. Christian, where does this energy debate go? I mean, gas prices are right front and center, and there's the president responding.
Well, I think there is an Iranian angle, as we were discussing earlier, but I do think the president has one Achilles heel in the energy debate, and that is the Keystone Pipeline. And I think that we should expect the Republicans to really, really be hammering that home, because it's fine for the president to say, you know, yes, I'm in favor of, you know, both using fossil fuels, who isn't? We all use them every day. We can't deny that. Mm-hmm. But also looking for alternative sources of energy. But I think the Republicans can very legitimately say, okay, that's great, but then why aren't we building this pipeline from Canada for a fossil fuel that we need? I think that's going to turn out to be a real political error.
Well, he's got heavy pressure from environmentalists, but you're right. It's going to be hard for him to say, yes, I'm for fossil fuels, and then dirty they may be, there they are, and Republicans willing to embrace them. Christy, you're in New York. What about the Goldman Sachs uproar this week over the resignation essay by a mid-level executive there who said it's become a toxic and destructive culture, not good for the clients, not good for the economy? How's that going down, Christian?
Well, you know, it has been, for me, a huge reminder at how sharply divided America is, because among the Wall Street class, you know, and especially, you know, the very senior Wall Street people, I spoke to one CEO of another Wall Street bank, and he said, look, it is absolutely in my self-interest to beat up on Goldman Sachs. They are my biggest rivals and competitors. But I think it was outrageous that the New York Times published this. It was absolutely shocking.
Why? I mean, he worked there. He was right in the middle of it. He reported what he saw. He said it wasn't pretty. We print things like that all the time.
I'm reporting to you the point of view of the Wall Street community. And their point of view is every organization has someone who complains, and that this was just a malcontent. And as to the point that there are conflicts of interest within Goldman Sachs, what you will hear from the Wall Street community is all businesses have conflicts of interest. And, you know, there is very much, and I personally find this very mystifying, but the fact is right now Wall Street feels under attack. They feel besieged. They feel the White House, which after all bailed them out, hates them, and they feel that this is all terribly unfair, and they are the victims of American politics right now.
And yet you're reporting, Emmanuel Saez, as The Economist says, the big winner since 2010, again, the 1% that gets the chance against him in the street, Christian. They're going to have to take some flack, I guess, while we've got that going on. Christian Friedland with Thomson Reuters Digital, great to have you with us today. Major Garrett with National Journal in Washington. Jack Beatty, thanks to you all. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.